Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it feel like to have depression? Those fortunate enough to have been spared a major depressive episode can sometimes find it hard to understand why anybody struck with the illness can't simply shake it off. My guest today admits he tended to hold that view, having counted himself among the brazenly undepressed for 45 years, until he fell into a persistent and debilitating melancholy almost overnight in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. David Guterson, whose novels include Snow Falling on Cedars and East of the Mountains, turns his focus on his own experiences for his latest project. His new memoir chronicling his depression is called Descent. It's been published as a vintage ebook original. And David Guterson joins us today from the studios of KPLU in Seattle. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
So, David, the trigger for your depression was the 9/11 attacks in 2001, but you make the point that there was nothing extraordinary about your personal experience of that day. Do you think now the disease would have manifested itself around that time, even if the attacks had not happened?
It may not have manifested itself around that time, but I'm quite sure that at some point it would have reared up, that for many people like myself, it lies in a sort of latent state, waiting for a kind of trigger, waiting for a kind of episode that allows it to manifest. And for me, that was 9/11.
So your first indication that your reaction was different from other people's was the following morning at breakfast. And of course, everybody's a little shocked, everybody's upset, but you couldn't believe that other people were able to eat anything.
I couldn't. I pretty quickly, within the first 24 hours, I began to notice that I myself felt more distressed and disturbed and aghast than everybody around me. At least that's the way it appeared. And one of the problems with depression is you see the world through a filter. You're not objective, and you begin to your subjectivity becomes sort of an inward mirror, and you lose track of the real world, and you can't make sense of what's going on around you. And I think within the first 24 hours after 9/11, this was happening to me.
What was really interesting about that anecdote is that it speaks to the earliest sense of alienation that was created by your depression. Suddenly you're slipping into this place that makes it hard to connect with other people.
Absolutely. In fact, eventually, as this deepens and you drop into this kind of well or sit under this bell jar, as Sylvia Plath described it, you can't relate to other human beings at all. And the very presence of other human beings is simply an occasion for anguish. The degree to which you shrivel and draw up and want to be alone and live inside yourself is, you know, it's incredibly punishing, this sense of enforced solitude and the desire you have to be utterly left alone in the world.
During the time that you were depressed, when you looked back at your life previously, when you had been happy and had sort of had a normal emotional response to things, how did you think about that time in your life while you were depressed?
I think when you fall into this, you very quickly begin to feel as if everybody who's happy is living in a delusion. And in fact, it is only the depressed who see clearly. And so anybody who's happy is absurdly deluded about reality. And not only do you view everybody around you through this lens, but you view your past life through this lens, and you feel convinced that you've now entered upon a truth. No matter how dismal and horrible it is, it appears to you as if this is the truth about reality.
Hmm. And you say the worst thing that you read during that time, the worst thing for you, was Ernest Becker's book, The Denial of Death.
Oh, yes. And I had read it before. But this time, reading it while depressed, acutely depressed, was really a mistake, because this is a book that makes the case that all of us, in fact, invent ourselves in a sort of heroic mythology to lend meaning to our lives as a way of denying the reality of our own deaths. And when you become aware of the degree to which you're intentionally deluding yourself because of this inevitable, horrible ending, you cannot continue with the pretense, and you become horribly aware of how everyone around you is engaged in this pretense of performing their lives in order to stave off a reality that they know deeply and well is coming for them.
Did you envy that ability in other people at this time, or did you resent it?
I think I had, as many depressed people do, mixed feelings. You know, on the one hand, you want to go back. You want to return to that kind of innocence and to an ordinary happiness, or you wish that somehow this episode would end and go away. I mean, you wish it with all every fiber of your being. You're crushed. At the same time, you feel as if there is no going back, because again, it's as if you've seen the truth. I mean, this is the consciousness of the depressed, this sense that you now know the darkness of reality and there's no going back.
It's almost like you've eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil and you can't get back into the Garden of Eden.
It is very much like that. There seems to be no going back. You know, once you've done that, you have eaten from the apple and there can be no return. Yes.
So, David, you also felt vulnerable in new ways, so that you started to see threats to your safety where none existed. Did the fact that 9/11 had everybody on edge for a while delay your realization that your perceptions were skewed?
Well, I think depression, acute clinical depression, manifests itself with different symptoms in different people. Mm-hmm. And anxiety, enormously ratcheted up anxiety, is often part of it, even paranoia. And of course, 9/11 was fertile ground for those symptoms for everybody. But if you're prone to, if you're vulnerable to acute depression, then that anxiety and that paranoia spins out of control. And you see horror everywhere. I mean, the very air itself seems to be potentially a problem because it could have anthrax, and therefore breathing itself can be an issue. You become absurdly paranoid. Hmm.
So you were actually in Washington, D.C. doing some work when 9/11 happened. You had to get all the way back to Seattle. You took a rental car. You had some people with you for a while. But then you got there after all this time, only to discover that home had lost all comfort for you.
Yeah, and it was a long journey all the way across country with two companions in a rental car. And we hurried the whole way. We were all urgent to get home. Mm-hmm. And I think all three of us felt like, well, once we get home, we'll have a sense of normalcy again. I mean, we're in dire straits here. It's not just 9/11. It's also the fact that we feel so far from home and our loved ones and everything we know. When I get home, I'll feel much better. And I was just very, very disappointed to find that really getting home made no difference whatsoever. I brought my depression with me.
How did your wife respond to the changes in you? Did she notice right away?
We all had the context of 9/11 in which to evaluate our friends and relatives, and everybody was anxious and on edge and nervous. And so it wasn't as if she was evaluating my well-being in a normal context. Mm-hmm. I think at first she probably believed that, like everybody else, I was upset about this enormous, cataclysmic event. But within a week or so, I think she began to see that my response was out of the norm. And at that point, she began to urge me to seek help, professional help.
So you went to your family doctor to talk about how you were feeling. And it seems to have been just sort of an uncomfortable conversation all around.
It was, up until then, he and I had been... I live in a small community. We were friends. We knew each other outside the office. And so for him to see me in this kind of despair, it just looked so unfamiliar to him, so out of character, like somebody he didn't know, that it really pained him. I could see his distress at seeing me this way. And he became quite somber and really didn't know how to help me, and so sent me on to a specialist in psychiatry.
And even just getting your prescription for Xanax filled struck you as just painful. The pharmacist almost wanted to, like, avoid eye contact. And it's funny because these are, you know, professionals, but it's still hard to look professionally at something when it affects a person you know personally.
Yeah. You know, there is so much stigma attached to depression. And when you live in a relatively small community and you know everybody at the grocery store, at the pharmacy, in the doctor's office, they're all people that you see on an ongoing basis. They know your name. They know you socially. Then the stigma, the sense of stigma, and the potential to feel that you're being judged negatively by those around you, well, it becomes exacerbated. It becomes more of a problem than it does, say, for someone who lives in a large city where their anonymity is, you know, can be protected. I didn't have that, and everywhere I turned, I felt as if people were judging me for being depressed. I felt like it was my fault. It wasn't like I had a cancer diagnosis, in which case everybody feels that you're a victim of something beyond your control. When you have depression, it seems to set people up for blaming you for having it, as if you're weak or it's somehow your fault.
Yeah, it's funny. If you had cancer, no one would think it was a character flaw.
No, not at all. I mean, the reaction, and that's really one of my one of the reasons I set about writing this is to address that stigma, that sense that the person who is depressed is somehow to blame, and why can't they just buck up and deal with it? We all have our bad moments. You know, that's a misunderstanding. It is a disease. It's something that has happened to you the way that cancer happens to you. It grips you and seizes you the way any disease does, and you're not to blame for that.
Did you make an effort early on to explain how you were feeling to your younger children who were still living at home at the time?
No, because at that point I stigmatized myself. I embraced and even embodied stigma. I didn't want to share it with anybody. I felt ashamed. I felt embarrassed, and particularly around my children, I felt ashamed and embarrassed. I didn't want them to see their father in this state. So I did my best to pretend in their presence that I was okay. And, you know, that was a really sort of difficult and painful act to be engaged in, to sort of keep up that pretense.
Well, it sounds excruciating. And then it was also, I guess, confusing for your wife and for your kids, because every once in a while you could muster the energy to pretend you were okay.
And it was confusing for me, too, at first, because I didn't know what was happening to me. I couldn't put a name to it. And it was a while before I realized, okay, this is what people are talking about when they talk about acute depression. That's what I am experiencing right now. I have a disease. And at that point, I felt less confused. I was able to put a name on it. But to the people around me, my friends and families, my family, it was just utterly confusing, because I wasn't acknowledging to them, this is what I have. These are the symptoms. It is a disease. And that gave them no way to come to grips with it.
My guest is writer David Guterson. His novels include Snow Falling on Cedars and East of the Mountains. His new memoir of his depression is called Descent. It's available as a vintage original ebook. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer David Guterson. His new memoir is called Descent. It's available as a vintage original ebook. If you'd like to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, what was it like to try to write while you were depressed?
Oh, completely impossible. Any sense of normalcy was gone. I mean, really, the only thing I wanted to do was sleep. Sleep was the only, if I was asleep, then I wasn't depressed. And when I woke up, I wished that I was asleep again. And if I couldn't be asleep, I wanted to be in bed with a pillow over my head. There just wasn't any will in me to do anything, write, eat, exercise, read. Well, I read only those things which seemed to hold out some hope of resolving my situation. But anything that sort of just felt like entertainment, a movie or television, seemed absurd to me, a sporting event, going out to do something that used to be an enjoyable pastime I had no interest in. It was either sleep or stay in bed curled up with a pillow over my head. Other than that, life seemed unavailable to me.
Yeah, you say reading while depressed is not really reading.
No, it isn't, because what you're doing is, in a very anxious way, you're searching for an answer. And at least in my case, I suffered from the belief that if I just kept turning pages or found the right author, that somewhere in there, somebody would have something to say to me that would get me out of this. Because the problem with depression, acute clinical depression, and this is an aspect of it that's not well understood, is the desperation. You have a feeling that you're being crushed every second, and you want out desperately. You want to sort of get this python that's wrapped around you to let go, and you're just desperate for something that will cause that to happen. And all you're doing all day long is looking for some way to get this sensation of being suffocated by the disease to go away, and you can't find it anywhere.
When was the first time you started thinking about that gun you owned?
Well, I had been spending all of my time in bed, either asleep or just, you know, laying there. And I felt so crushed, and I felt in such horrible pain, literal physical, mental, emotional, psychological torment, that I began to think to myself, there is a way out. And I would say that happened within about 3 weeks. Mm. I couldn't take it. After about 3 weeks, the pain was too much. And I began to think about that. And that of course, really frightened me to be thinking about that.
So you did, soon after you started feeling sick, you saw a counselor. And then you felt very listened to and cared for by this person, but were surprised to find that he wasn't making you better.
No, I went through the sort of whole trajectory of seeking professional help, first going to my family physician who just prescribed something that would, you know, decrease the anxiety I was feeling, and then referring me on. I went to a counselor whose approach was, you know, really not very well thought out. It felt generic. It felt that he was trying to comfort me, but not really get to the heart of the thing, and I quickly gave up on that. Ended up going to someone else who referred me on to a Jungian. And I spent some time doing that, which was mostly about dream analysis. And that too seemed absurd. I think when you're as deeply depressed as I was, that nothing anybody has to say to you can really penetrate. It all seems hopeless and ridiculous. You're not amenable to that kind of professional help when you're so far down inside of it.
So why were you initially somewhat resistant to the idea of accepting a prescription for Prozac?
Well, I think it goes back to that notion of stigma that I mentioned earlier, that mm-hmm. once you start taking the pills, you're acknowledging that you have a disease, you're acknowledging it to yourself. And then, of course, you're manipulating your own internal chemistry in such a way that, at least I feared, maybe I won't be myself after this. Maybe I won't recognize myself. Maybe my happiness will be false. And do I really want to do this to myself, to sort of lose my authenticity, to lose touch with myself in this way? And yet I desperately wanted to take the pill because anything was worth it to feel better.
And then, of course, it takes weeks and weeks for the effect to be felt, if it will work at all.
Right. I mean, first of all, there's a question of whether this particular SSRI is going to work at all. And then if it does work, how long is it going to be before it starts working? And so you take the pill and you're saying to yourself, if this is going to help, I won't know it for 6 weeks. And the chances that it's going to help are probably less than 50-50. So you feel kind of desolate about the whole thing, but you feel also that you have no choice.
And then when it finally did begin to work, it wasn't like you woke up one morning and felt great. You just realized that you were thinking about things other than feeling awful.
Yeah, well, I'm not even sure that it did work. I mean, I don't know why I got better. It could have been medication. It could have been other things. Sometimes just the passing of a certain amount of time will begin to alleviate the symptoms for people. Sometimes it can be the help that you're getting talking to someone to a psychiatrist, or it can be a combination of those things, the medication, time, and the talk therapy. I don't know, you know, how exactly I came out of it, but I know that I did. After about 4 months, I just began to notice that I was feeling better. And it took, you know, a couple of months, say January and February, before I really felt back to normal. But it was such a relief. It was as if suddenly that python had just let go a little bit and I could breathe again.
Let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Dia on the line in Louisville. Hi, Dia.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I kind of know what he's talking about. I went through a depression, and it seems like it kind of goes in stages. But it seems like there was a situation with my work and my health, and it got to the point where I felt like there was a stronger force, like to the point where you start hearing whispers. And it seems like those whispers may turn into voices, and it'll make you kind of do things that you normally wouldn't do. Like one day at work, I was so depressed. Excuse me. I went to the rail, and I wanted to just jump off the rail, but I knew that that wasn't me. I knew it wasn't me, and I said something's wrong. And I prayed, and like him, I took medicine, the Xanax. And I got to the point where I said that there's nothing in this world that's worth my life, not a job, not anything. And I said if my health doesn't improve, I was just going to try to go away from the situation, take some leave time off work. And like with him, I got to the point where I didn't care. It seems like when I stopped worrying about it, when I stopped trying to do the right thing, got to the point where I just let it all go, I started getting better. So with people that have problems, and now I haven't had any more problems, but when I think about it, it still hurts me and it worries me, because I went to a psychologist and I was afraid to tell people because I didn't want them to label me as a psychotic or crazy.
Well, Dia, I so appreciate you sharing your story. Thank you. And I'm glad to know that you are doing better. It sounds like a lot that you can relate to there, David.
Well, yes, most of it. But I think when a person begins to say, hear voices that are telling, in this case, her to do something she might not normally do, that is a symptom of schizophrenia. And it's not part of the profile of clinical acute depression. Now, certainly the two can combine, and everyone has a different individual experience. But if someone is hearing voices and feels sort of controlled or urged to some action, like perhaps suicide, by an inner voice, it really is time to seek help and to look for medication, perhaps, that addresses the schizophrenic symptoms.
Another interesting thing that you experienced was, you know, you talked to your siblings who obviously were concerned, but everybody sort of wanted to attach a reason to why at this moment in your life you were feeling depression. Some of your siblings said, well, it's mom and dad, clearly. And that you didn't feel like that was, you could put your finger on it in that way.
No, I think, you know, when somebody who is deeply depressed has a conversation with somebody who isn't, the person on the other side is out of empathy. They want to give advice and they want to make suggestions. They want to help you feel better. And so they articulate whatever it is in their lives that have made them feel better. Well, I did a lot of thinking about our parents, and that helped me come to terms with some depression I had, or I've become religious, or I follow this spiritual path, or I read this book. And all of those things, when you're depressed, they just make no sense to you at all. You just feel that that person is living in some kind of pretense where they think this insoluble problem of life is somehow solvable with a regime or a program. It isn't when you're depressed.
You know, it's interesting reading that section where you write about your friends and your family and people who did unquestionably care about you. It almost sounds like the sort of advice you get when you have a cold, right? And everybody tells you what you're supposed to do. And if it's not working for you, it really doesn't matter. That becomes useless.
It becomes useless. And you, again, this sense you have of wanting to drop away from the world and get away from everybody. Nobody's saying anything to you that matters. I mean, they're doing their best. They're being empathetic and they want to help and they feel horrible for you. But from within your own sort of darkness, everything they're saying seems completely useless and they seem to you blind and nobody can help you.
When you look back on this time, when you sat down to write this memoir, what questions did you have to ask yourself about how much to trust your memories of this time in your life?
You know, when you have a dramatic episode like this, your memory is heightened. I had a very lucid and intense sense of recall of detail when I was working on this. It was very vivid to me. It's a dramatic experience, and it haunts you, and it doesn't go away. You can't lose track of it. I think you see this with post-traumatic, you know, stress disorder, too. People have very, very vivid memories of whatever triggered that, and it's the same with acute depression. You remember everything in great detail.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Eric in Dallas. Hello, Eric.
Hello. I missed the first 10 minutes of the call, so I may have the context slightly wrong, but my question for your guest today is, did you get to the point where you just didn't feel overwhelmed and depressed anymore, or did you get to the point where you just learned to cope with it? Just to add a little color, I started feeling somewhat hopeless about society, somewhat post-911, but it really magnified during the financial crisis, and since then, over the last 5 years, I've kind of started to lose faith in humanity. In a little extra context, my mother grew up as a child in the World War II. She remembers living in an occupied country. And I've heard some stories about how miserable people can be to one another. It just seems like as a society, we've kind of lost the understanding that we all live together and we do have to try to get along together. And that's a piece I've kind of just lost hope on, and it seems to be kind of spiraling down out of control. So going back to the question, did you get to the point where you just didn't feel bad anymore, or did you learn to just cope with your depression?
Well, thank you for that question. It's a good one. If there is any silver lining to the episodic acute clinical depression, which is the form that I've experienced, is that it is acute and it has a beginning and it has an end. And when it ends, you're out of it. And it's not as if you have this other kind of depression, which is far more pervasive, common, and widespread, which is chronic malaise that sort of comes and goes, where you carry it as sort of a low-level disorder in an ongoing sense. This acute clinical depression is a very, very devastating, all-consuming disease, but it is episodic, and so it begins and then it ends, for which I'm very, very grateful. Although it can recur, you can have multiple episodes. That's part of what's frightening about it, is you know how horrible it is, and you know it can happen to you again.
What did you learn as an artist yourself about the link between particular gifts in the arts and an apparently heightened risk of depression and other kinds of mental illness?
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of anecdotal evidence out there that people in the so-called creative arts, you know, writers and artists and so on, suffer more commonly from depression than the general population. And there have been different sort of statistics thrown around with regard to that. But it's astonishing how many people who are creative do experience depression, or even more commonly, manic depression. And during their upcycle, the manic part of the disease, they become very, very creative, but then they pay for it with these lows. And there can be a kind of correspondence between creativity and depression or manic depressiveness, absolutely.
Is this something that you now are comfortable talking with about with your wife and with your children now that it's over?
You know, so it's now been about a dozen years since this happened to me. And during that time, I've come to grips that it did happen. There's no reason to feel stigmatized by it or embarrassed about it. And it's time to talk about it for a number of reasons. One is, I do think that professional people, psychiatrists, counselors, and so on, can benefit from these first-person testimonials, that it gives them insight so that they are able to conduct their professional work, you know, more effectively. I think it also helps family and friends of people who are depressed to contend, to understand better what's happening to this person in their life who's suffering and about whom they feel so confused. And finally, I think it can benefit the depressed person, him or herself, because I know when I was depressed, how lonely I felt and how wonderful it was to come across, in particular, William Styron's Darkness Visible, which I read greedily because he was telling me that I wasn't alone, that somebody else had experienced what I had experienced.
My guest is writer David Guterson. His novels include East of the Mountains and Snow Falling on Cedars. His new memoir, Descent, is now available as a vintage original ebook. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer David Guterson about his new book, Descent, a memoir of madness, which is available now as a vintage original ebook. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, do you still live with, or did you for some time live with, the sort of constant nagging fear that this feeling might come back and might stay with you?
It's something that I think anybody who has experienced acute clinical depression, you live with that for the rest of your life. You are haunted by the possibility that you could descend into that morass again. And while that's, you know, kind of a pall over your life, you know, create a sense of underlying fear of a recurrence, it also opens into a kind of opportunity, because once you feel better, you begin to ask yourself, why did that happen? And what can I do to prevent it from happening again? So in that regard, it presents, you know, opportunity for growth. And you're very, very motivated by the fact that you don't want to experience it again.
So does it change the way you, say, take care of yourself in stressful situations, or after you have an argument with someone, or that sort of thing?
It does. Well, it can. I think not everybody emerges from acute depression in a sort of productive frame of mind. That, I think, is you know, potentially the downside of relying entirely on medication, is that perhaps you then don't address this underlying problems that may have triggered the symptoms. And then after a while, people wonder how they would be without the medication. They go off of it, And because they haven't dealt with the underlying problems, they descend again into depression. So you've got to address those, the kinds of things that you mentioned. Maybe if you're in a disagreement or a conflict with somebody, you need to develop kind of awareness of what you're feeling and why you're feeling it, and not allow yourself to go into this kind of looping, you know, self-loathing, where your mind tells your body to feel anxious, and then the anxiety in your body tells your mind that something's wrong. And this looping between the body and the mind just keeps deepening. You know how to break that. You become aware that it's happening.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Vic in Plano. Hello, Vic.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I have two questions. I was wondering if the author self-diagnosed himself as being depressed, and B, what was the effect upon his family, his relationship with wife and kids during his period of depression?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, well, you know, after about a week, I knew that something was very, very wrong and that it probably had some kind of clinical name. And I knew that I had to seek professional help. I didn't know that the term for it was acute clinical depression, but I knew that I had some serious symptoms. And so it might be parallel to somebody who begins in a disease that presents in the strict physical sense, like cancer at first. You know, you have a malaise, and you don't feel well, you have headaches, you know something's wrong, you don't have a name for it. It's not until you seek professional help that somebody diagnoses you and says, here is what you have. So I knew something was wrong. I didn't have a name for it. As far as family goes, it can be devastating to the family. Somebody that has been dependable, has been depended on, somebody who has a role among others that is counted on, is completely lost and appears to be completely helpless and despairing and can't do anything but, you know, lie in bed all day, is very, very distressing and disturbing and disrupts family life horribly. And it takes a lot of love and understanding for friends and family to help somebody through it.
Do you have any thoughts, given the time that has passed and the conversations I'm sure you've had, on what to do for family members surrounding someone who is coping with a major clinical depression?
One of the things my wife told me about afterwards was how much she depended on her very, very good friends to have a dialogue with about it and to tell them, this is what's happening with, you know, my husband, and I'm having a very, very difficult time with it. And just to be able to process it with people who were close to her was really the best thing for, particularly to run into people who were familiar with this, who had experienced it themselves and were able to tell her, you know, this runs its course. It takes some patience, but, you know, he will get over it and your life will turn around. So not only finding friends, but talking to people who are familiar with this disease.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Kelly in Dallas on the line now. Hello, Kelly.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to, you described your experience going from doctor to doctor and how it was kind of frustrating, an experience of just kind of being passed along. I wanted to know your thoughts on, since it's been about 12 years and we have a little bit better understanding of depression now, how do you think the healthcare industry is responding, and specifically like benefit-wise? Like, I know I have benefits through my employer, and they provide for, you know, 3 or 4 psychiatric visits a year, but when you're going through something like acute depression, it would sound like you need something a little bit more than that.
You really do, and putting this particular disease in this larger context of the debate about healthcare and health insurance in our country, I think it's important for people to begin to recognize that acute clinical depression is a disease that needs professional treatment and not just, you know, malaise, something wrong with you that you can deal with yourself. But in the terms of what's covered by insurance programs, it's very rarely treated that way. It's peripheral, it's off to the side, and nobody really feels that, in fact, you need the kind of thorough help and treatment that you would get if your disease was something else. It's part of the stigma that attaches to depression. It's not viewed with the same sort of serious, you know, medical, in the same serious medical context as other diseases.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, David, that your wife got support from her friends as she talked about trying to help you. Did your friends, I mean, like your male friends, did they bring up the subject first, or did you have to finally decide that you were going to open up and talk to them about what you were experiencing?
Well, you know, again, I didn't want to see anybody at all. I wasn't asleep. I was in bed. I didn't call anybody. I didn't look anybody up. But the problem was, I did have on my calendar these sort of obligations that I had set up before I was depressed, and I felt somehow obliged to those. I felt that I couldn't cancel. I don't know exactly why I felt that, but I did feel obligated to meet all the appointments that I'd made. And so that brought me into contact with friends and other people. And in a couple of cases, I was very, very open and sharing with a couple of very, very close friends. I simply laid it all on the table and told them how I was feeling. And that was helpful. It was really great to have a couple of people like that to lean on. But in the main, my feeling, and I think the feeling of most people who have this disease, is to turn away from other human beings.
Did you, once you were healthy again, did you have to go back? Did you feel a sense that you needed to sort of repair whatever damage had been done, not because you wanted to do it, but because you were not able to be there for your family for a number of months?
Absolutely. You feel, well, I guess what I really felt was that I had been very, very fortunate, and that the people in my life had really been a gift to me and had been patient with me and had helped me through. And this is one thing that's not very well understood about serious depression. You can die from it, and many, many people do die from it. And if you don't have support, you will die from it. If somebody doesn't put food in front of you and make you eat it, you'll starve to death because you don't want to eat anything. You will not take care of yourself. And so I felt such gratitude to the people who had helped me through it that when I got over it, I told myself, I can never repay them for what they've done, but I can try. And it was a change for me. I didn't take people for granted at all.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Glenn on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. Thanks for the show. I've enjoyed it. I can certainly relate. I've battled with depression through periods in my life. Thanks be to God, I can say that I've actually had a stretch now, probably 10, 15 years, where I've just been doing very well. I did seek out help for it, both medication and counseling. And I would just like to make the comment, see what your guest has to say. It's just amazing after you've been through something like depression, clinical depression, when you get through it, how perceptive you are at others who are going through it. It's almost like you can just recognize it so quickly. I'm not saying I can read everyone's soul and all that. I'm not gifted in any way. You just recognize it and you can sense it. You know it when you see it. And how many people just are so reluctant to seek any kind of help, particularly men, you know? And I would just say there's probably a lot of people listening right now who can relate to his story and are suffering. But they've got that thought in the back of their head that says, but I'm different. I'll be okay. I don't need to get help. You know, I'll push through it. It's going to be all right. Don't need it. And I just like to say you're just deluding yourself most of the time, I think. Seek the help. You'll be so glad you did. There is help, and it does work. You know, I for me, it was a combination initially of medication and counseling. I would actually look at someone who only prescribes medication and doesn't try to encourage counseling in some way with a little skepticism.
Well, Glenn, thank you so much for your call, and that sort of echoes some of the things that you've been saying over this hour, David Guterson.
Yes, I absolutely agree with the caller that the depressed are kind of tribe, and you know each other. When you look into the eyes of somebody who is experiencing it, you feel that at least you believe you know what they're going through. And you also believe that people who haven't been there cannot know. And that's part of the horrible frustration of this disease. It seems that you cannot articulate it to anybody. You've got this terrible pain, and the impossibility of sharing it is a component of that pain. It contributes to it. It's part of the frustration of it, is that you cannot seem to go over this divide. As I think Sylvia Plath's idea of the bell jar is right. Now, there's glass between you and the world.
When you sat down to write about this, David, did you begin tentatively with the concern that maybe really reliving this enough to articulate it fully on the page would trigger another episode for you?
No, I can see how, it's certainly a legitimate question that somehow by writing about it, you're immersing yourself in it again, and that kind of immersion might be dangerous. But it never, in fact, felt that way. On the contrary, it felt, therapeutic. And the truth was, whether I was writing it or not, I was haunted by it, and it was vivid to me. Writing it didn't deepen the degree to which I was haunted by it, but what it did do was allow a kind of outlet. It allowed it to emerge from this sort of inner private silent space and find, a place in the world. So, I didn't have trepidation about writing about it. And I think that writing about it turned out to be healthy for me.
Was your publisher instantly enthusiastic about this title, or is there still some reluctance to publish a book like this because people might somehow find it threatening to read?
No, there was no reluctance. I have a fantastic editor and a fantastic publisher, and I told them I like to publish this because, well, the reasons I mentioned earlier, because I think it can help professionals, I think it can help family and friends, and I think it can help the depressed itself. This is just work that I want to do in the world. I want to get this out. And when I told them that, they said, great, we'll help you. And that's all there was to it, really.
Writer David Guterson's new book is called Descent. It's been published as a vintage ebook original, and he joined us today from the studios of KPLU in Seattle. David, it's been a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is sponsored in part by the Horchow family, celebrating the vast array of ideas heard each day on KERA.